You're listening to the Tipsy Nerds Book Club Podcast, your home for the best of science fiction and fantasy, with a twist. Whether you prefer your stories with dragons or aliens, your beverages shaken or stirred, fill your glass, relax, and join the conversation with your hosts, sci-fi and fantasy authors and proud Tipsy Nerds, Natalie Wright and R.S. Dabney.
How would you like to win a signed copy of Wool by Hugh Howey and other nerdy swag? Stay tuned until the end of the episode for an announcement about our May contest and how you can win these and other fabulous prizes. A special thank you to our newest patron on Patreon, Rayleigh Gold, who purchased a top shelf martini. We appreciate Rayleigh and all of our sponsors who help to keep the lights on here at Tipsy Nerds Book Club. So cheers to you, Rayleigh. This episode of Tipsy Nerds Book Club Podcast, supported by author C.D. Tavener and his new science fiction release, First of Their Kind. Check out the very cool cover and blurb for the book on the Season 1 page of our website at tipsynerdsbookclub.com. Welcome, Tipsy Nerds, book lovers, sci-fi fans, curiosity seekers, to Episode 4 of the Tipsy Nerd Book Club. Today, we will be discussing the international bestseller, Wool. I am your host, Natalie Wright, and with me is co-host Robin Dabney. Hello, Robin.
Hi, Natalie. I'm already a little bit tipsy. How are you today?
I'm doing well. You sound like you're also doing well.
I am. I have this awesome drink I've created for today's book, and I'm really excited to have our guest here with us today, Hugh Howey, to talk about his book, Wool.
Yes, we have Hugh Howey in the house today. Hugh, of course, is the author of the book we'll be discussing, Wool. He's an international best-selling author, a sailor, world traveler, a champion of indie authors everywhere, and an all-around just really cool guy. So we're very excited to have a chat with Hugh Howey today. Hi, Hugh. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Already a little tipsy.
All right. Well, we're going to start with you, Hugh, and hear about what's in your glass. And just so listeners know, by the time this airs, you know, it'll be a completely different time. But Hugh, what time is it in the morning where you are right now?
It's almost 6 a.m.
All right. And what's in your glass?
Well, since it's 6 o'clock in the morning, I didn't want to do something too complex. So I actually poured my usual 6 o'clock beverage, and it's just some straight up tequila. It's Azulejos. It's a beautiful bottle. It happens to be what was in the fridge. And I'm drinking it out of a sake cup in order to, I don't know, mix the cultural influences here. Yeah, I haven't had anything to eat yet. So, and I'm a lightweight. I don't drink a lot.
So drinking tequila at 6 a.m. is a very solid breakfast strategy.
Yeah, just so you know, when I blocked a day off my calendar for you ladies, I blocked the whole day off because this is probably going to ruin it.
Well, we appreciate that.
You'll have to go take a nap after this.
Yeah. We really love that you're embracing it.
Is napping what you call passing out?
Yes, exactly. Napping is passing out for adults.
Well,
I'll call that a nap too. Yeah, that sounds healthy. I'll call it a nap as well. What I'll do.
Yeah,
later.
Perfect.
You're just gonna have a little power nap afterward. That's awesome.
Exactly.
He was embracing the whole vibe of Tipsy Nerds. I'm gonna save you for last, Robin, because your drink is the most exciting one today. I heard through the grapevine note. I heard from Hugh directly that his favorite drink is an old fashioned. So I went on a search for a new take on an old fashioned, and it's really lovely. It's a fig, vanilla, orange infused syrup and with bourbon. And I'm doing Maker's Mark today because I was feeling it for the Maker's Mark bourbon. And yeah, and some orange in there. It's so good. Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Well, if you were here, which you're not, I would make one for you, but maybe sometime. And Robin, what are you drinking? Tell us all about this.
So I have made a layered shooter that I am calling the Silo 17, obviously inspired by Silo 17 in the book. There are three layers to this drink, and it kind of reminds me of being back in college because it's really strong. So I on the bottom layer, representing the down deep, I've got rum chata. You could also use Bailey's if you wanted to. I just am more of a rum chata fan. And then above that, I've got Goldschlager, which again, this is taking me back to my college days, but I have representing the mid-levels. IT, it just seems kind of like a foofy, fancy mid-level type of drink. And then on top, I've got 151 or any really strong proof rum. It kind of has that same hazy color that I picture the windows having before a cleaning happens. And it also lights on fire really well, which is kind of the purpose of this drink. I was inspired by the front cover of the book also for that final touch. So you've got this beautiful three-layer drink representing kind of the three layers of the silo. And then you torch that baby and it's got this beautiful blue flame on top of it. Sort of a terrifying drink. I'm going to work really hard to get through this interview and not be totally falling all over the place. But yeah, it's a really cool drink.
I love the concept you came up with. That's amazing. I want to make one of those. And I think it should be immortalized as the Silo 17. That's such a great name for a drink too.
I will get recipes and photos posted online when the show airs. So anybody out there who wants to make this, look for it on our Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, our website, and please duplicate it and send us some photos.
Great.
Awesome.
And be careful, Robin, and any of you tipsy nerds that try the drink. First of all, we absolutely want you to make one and send us photos of it. Tag us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We want to see it. Tag you. We want to see your Silo 17 drinks. But please be careful and don't like burn your eyebrows off or like burn your house down. Make sure it goes out.
Only you can prevent silo fires.
I love it.
You bring up a good point, Natalie. This thing is on fire. So before you drink it, please blow it out and maybe blow it out twice, because the first time I lit it on fire, I blew it out and I thought it was out, but there was this like thin layer of fire still on it. So again, we like this cool drink, but really like make sure that fire is out before you pour that down your throat.
So Hugh, for anyone listening who has not already read Wool, there might be a few people out there that haven't. Could you give us a little bit of a setup about the book?
So it's a story about people living underground who have no idea how they got there or how long they've been there or that they've ever lived anywhere else. And as the power structure of the silo they live in starts to break down, people begin to uncover and question their origins. And at the center of the story is this mechanic named Juliet, who comes from the very bottom of the silo, the mechanical depths of the silo. And it's a very stratified society. And she gets promoted into a position as silo sheriff that she's kind of ill-equipped but perfectly suited for. And she's very obstinate. And in this position, she starts to poke into places that she shouldn't. And the results are pretty catastrophic and awesome.
Awesome is a great way to describe it. This was my first time reading Wool, and I was completely pulled into the book. It was such a cool take on this dystopian genre that I really hadn't seen before.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I first read Wool back, I think, when it came out, probably in 2012. And I just read it again. And I have to say, I don't know why I keep calling
it. That's
wrong
with me. It could be the alcohol.
I mean, it's a really common name. You know, like Bob, Tom, Wool.
Yeah. Well, Robin and I say this all the time. We have a built-in excuse for how idiotic we may sound from time to time. It's because we're drinking while we're talking. But
I'm going to start writing drunk. So like any typo, I'm like, I'm drunk. What do you expect? Come on.
Yes, that's a fantastic idea.
Right, exactly. It's the bourbon. Okay, Hugh. I loved it just as much, if not more, the second time that I read it. So it's a really wonderful book. And anyone who hasn't read it, I think Robin and I both really highly recommend it. Would you agree, Robin?
Absolutely. I've already ordered the second book in the series. I'm hooked. I'm a fan. I think it's something that any fan of dystopian literature should definitely take a look at.
Well, I think the lesson here is that if you enjoyed it even more the second time, that everyone should go out and buy two copies so that they enjoy the second reading even better.
Yeah, I mean, by the second book or just by the first book twice, either way, you're good to go.
That's where you're heading with this, right?
Yeah,
For sure.
However you go about buying this series, it's definitely worth reading.
Well, yeah, we absolutely want people to read the book. But Hugh, I have a question. I have many questions for you. But one question I have is, I was listening to a prior interview of you from some years back, and you were talking about your inspiration for wool. And you were talking about how like an early death of a beloved animal companion was one of the inspirations for the story. I don't know if you remember, I don't know what interview it was at this time, at this point, but that really struck me as interesting because I wouldn't have really seen that in the book. And I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit more. Like, what did you mean by that? What was going on and how is that reflected in?
Yeah. So I didn't write this all out as a full novel. I actually wrote, I guess you'd call it a novelette. It was about 12 to 13,000 words in the original piece. And it was a departure from everything that I was writing at the time. And it was, in my mind, the least commercial thing that I had written. And it was more catharsis and just for myself than anything else. I was in a really dark place after losing a dog of 9 years that I had hoped I would have a few more years with. And not having kids, that dog was like a child to me.
Right.
And one of the most difficult things I've ever been through. And yeah, so I wrote a story that was like a completely different tone and a lot darker. And not to spoil too much, but like there are permanent consequences in this short story. A lot of characters are lost and doesn't have the brightest of endings. And I'd never really written anything like that. And so when I put it on Amazon for 99 cents, I just published it because I don't believe in keeping things unpublished. Yeah, I was really surprised that this was the thing that took off and launched my writing career because it was not written with any of that in mind. Later, when I had a lot of demand for more in the story, I had to flesh it out into a novel. And I think the theme of grief pretty much self-contained in that first bit. So I don't know that the inspiration carries on to the rest of the book, but it's definitely what got the whole thing started.
That's amazing. I mean, I definitely, upon rereading, I would say that one of the things I really noticed was your treatment of Marnes and Johns and Holston. Now I'm a little bit older than the first time I read it. I really related to those characters so very much and felt that you really nailed the experience of aging and of regret and of like the knowledge that the clock is ticking, that, you know, that they're moving towards the end of their life in a way that I hadn't really noticed before when I read it. And so how old were you when you wrote this story?
I was probably 34, maybe 33 or 34, which is quite young. But that notion of time slipping away is something that I've been like morbidly focused on and terrified by since I was very young, probably 11 or 12, started thinking about that was a dark period of my life where I was like writing poetry about death and losing my faith and realizing that at some point in the past, not too distant past, I didn't exist. And that was going to happen again in the future. And I wouldn't remember anything that ever happened and all that really nihilistic stuff that I think a lot of people go through at some point in their life. And that motivated me really early on to not put things off, like things that I dreamed about doing. I always assumed I would only have like 40 years for some reason on Earth. And I think doing that was a conscious effort to not put off any of my dreams and not get caught into a career and a debt cycle where I was having to just earn money to spend what I was living off of until I was like 65 and then see what kind of health and money and time I had left to do the things that I wanted to do. Yeah, the fear of mortality and the sense that we don't have a lot of time on Earth has been a huge motivator in my personal life. And I think it comes out in a lot of my writing as well.
That's incredibly fascinating. I can see that.
I need another drink now.
Drink.
It's so uplifting.
Well, but on the other hand, I mean, I kind of relate to what you're saying because my husband and I have been together a very long time and his parents were the kind of people that never did anything and save. And it's like, we're going to do this when we retire. And then pretty much as soon as they retired, they both got very ill and couldn't do anything. And so they really kind of never went anywhere and did anything. And so we've been like, fuck it, we're going to spend all our money, you know, like just kind of live a life and try to travel and do what we wanted to do. So I can relate to that sentiment. And I think it's fascinating how that comes out in your writing. But I also just want to say that I was really moved by your treatment of these older folks in the book. It's, I think, some of the best part of it for me is, you know, how they are at the beginning.
Thanks. Yeah, it's funny how I get a lot of feedback about how so many of my characters don't make it to the end of my books. And I think it's sad that that's not more common, because that's, you know, every fictional character is going to die at some point. Most of them are mortal, and that's the inevitable end. And we don't get to see the end of very many character stories because we don't want to, I guess, offend or upset the reader. But for me as a completionist, like, I would love to know these characters that I really love. I would love to know what the last days or what the full arc of their life is like. And it's funny to me that and I think this is true for myself as a reader, like, I'm shocked when a character I love dies on the page in front of me, but also appreciate the honesty of it, because part of me knows that's going to happen for all the characters that I love, and not seeing it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I guess it's the same way that some people can only eat meat because they don't think about where it comes from.
Right.
And I would rather any kind of art or entertainment, like, be discomforting and honest and real and impactful. And as someone enjoys that on the consumption end, it's the kind of stories I like to create, like something that you'll remember and not just be entertained by in the moment.
Right. Absolutely. And Wool is one of those books that for me, like, for days, if not a week or so after reading it, I was still thinking about it. Thinking about what I'd read, thinking about the meaning, thinking about the characters. And we've only just talked about sort of the beginning, but there's this, we don't want to give too many things away or spoil it, but Juliet has a fascinating story. You know, Hollywood just keeps trying to make these, quote, strong female characters. And it's sort of a thing now to have the, quote, strong female character. And we talk a lot about what that means. And we just felt that Juliet is probably one of the strongest characters, male or female, we've ever read. I mean, this woman just never, you know, she is a never give up kind of person. What inspired you to write Jules? I mean, are there any real life people, male or female, or beings that you know that help inspire you to create this character that just never gives up and will fight to the death for her people? You know, she's just there for her people.
Yeah, I would definitely say I was raised by a single mom. She at one point was working three jobs to keep the lights on for the three kids that she was raising by herself. And my little sister, Molly, is just an amazing person. Like, is not, just doesn't feel peer pressure. So she's one of the people who's like her own person in a way that very few people are, which, you know, allows a dichotomy of conflicting kind of personality traits to all mix, because she's not, you know, trying to fit into a vessel.
Right.
And I would say my mom and my sister, just because they were the two people closest to me, it's not that they were like female influences in my life. They were just influences in my life.
Right.
And I think the other thing, when I write, I write as a reader who wants to read a story I haven't read before. I can't write a story unless I'm really into it with my own curiosity piqued and wanting to see what happens next. So I think there's just stories missing from the marketplace. I love finding those gaps and trying to slot, you know, one book in that very large gap that other people are also filling as well. What has always bothered me about the strong female character trope is that we basically take what we think of as typically male testosterone-based kind of traits and put them into a woman and, you know, give a woman like muscles and make her physically strong and aggressive and angry. And I don't know, we basically put a male hero into a female body and say, look what we did. And I think the strength of women in my life has been physical power. But more than that, like, what arises out of someone who has a level of compassion or an ability to think through a problem while also figuring out how it's going to impact other people with nuance rather than bulldozing their way through a problem. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be stereotypical, like all women are this way and all men are that way, because that's nonsense. Everybody's on a spectrum. But there is a flavor for what an amazing female influence in your life has felt like versus a male influence. When I think of the teachers who inspired me, the women in my life have definitely been more nurturing than the men, who were more like browbeating. Some of that is my bias and how I see and absorb their influences. But I do think that there are differences across that gender spectrum, and we should celebrate and highlight those rather than saying like what makes a strong female character strong is that she acts like what we think of as a male hero. I think that's just too easy of an out, and the reality should be a lot more complex.
Well, I 100% agree with you. And what I try to talk with people about is the concept of agency. In Wool, Juliet has tons of agency. You know, she is there to live her own story. She is not a window dressing or someone on the arm of somebody else. She doesn't serve the story by serving the needs of another character.
A big thing that was happening when I was writing Wool was the love triangle. People were reading about female protagonists whose like number one challenge in life was trying to figure out how to choose between like two really awesome male suitors, you know, the Twilight series and Hunger Games. It's like some of the biggest series of young adult and just, you know, sci-fi fantasy had a problem, which I've never encountered in my life, where I have like two amazingly hot people who both wanted me at the same time. And like my torture is trying to figure out which one, like flip a coin, like, and maybe that's the allure. Most of us are sitting there going like, I would take half of one of those people, you know, after me.
Right.
And I think that's really cool what you're saying about agency, because that is that when that becomes the plot, like your character arc is choosing which guy is going to make you happy. That's just not satisfying to me. I don't want to tell a story like that, and I don't want to read it. And I actually almost didn't have a romantic arc for Juliet at all, because I was kind of rebelling against this idea.
Right.
And with Wool, I almost didn't have the first draft didn't have a romantic connection at all. And I had to realize, yeah, that's a little too unrealistic, and added Lucas in a way that it became central to the story, but not central to her story. That was something I deliberately was like trying to avoid, because I think you can live a full life without, you know, having to create a family or have to live it for someone else. If you can make that connection happen and if you can have that family, that's awesome. But I think we tend to treat that as like the only way to live a life, and thank goodness life is a lot more complex than that.
Right, exactly. Well, the relationship between Lucas and Juliet is very organic to the story. And as a reader, you don't know quite where it's going to go. It's not a foregone conclusion that she's going to fall in love with him or he's going to fall in love with her. And even at the end of the book, I would say that you're not 100% certain as a reader where it's going to go, which for me was very satisfying because it's unpredictable, which brings us to another point, you know, really about your writing, which is that it is unpredictable in a really good way. You know, as a reader, you don't always know what's going to happen. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that seems to be a hallmark really of your writing is, you know, what happens with Holston at the very beginning is like, what the, what the hell? Yeah. You know, again, I don't want to give it away, but whatever happens with him, you know, listeners, it's a real big shocker. And then I would say the same with John's. It's just like shocking. And those surprises continue. So can you tell us a little bit about that, about surprise in your writing?
Well, it's something I enjoy as a reader and as a moviegoer and a TV binger. You know, I don't want to get lulled into complacency, and I don't want to, my interest will just wane if I feel like I'm seeing the same thing over and over again, the same conversation or the same struggle, the same arc. I grew up on comic books, and I love that there was a much larger arc over a year or even decades with a character,
right.
But every issue had its own arc as well, its own beginning, middle, and end. And it was that episodic nature, like a really good serialized TV show, like Breaking Bad, where each season has a plot, the whole series has a plot, but every hour you have some kind of bit of a climax and some drama and some satisfying conclusion and some new mystery that opens up. When I wrote my very first book, my first Molly Fide book, I was really trying to capture that sense of like every chapter could be completely different. This wasn't going to be girl looking for her father, and here's like 300 pages of her just thinking about that. You know, in the interim, she's going to have to deal with as much conflict and drama as possible. And another thing I don't like is like when you can tell the writer has an idea of where the plot needs to go. And so they have a very perfect straight line from the beginning of the story to where the character needs to end up. Because life just doesn't go on a straight line like that.
Right.
And so every one of these plot twists is basically what happens, you know, in our life when we're, you know, trying to run a very simple errand and it turns into an all-day ordeal with all kinds of interruptions and mishaps, that to me makes a better story.
Right.
So I'm always, anytime I'm writing, if I'm even a little bit bored, I'm like, what could possibly go wrong right here? It's come to think of it, I think about that a lot in life, actually. And anytime I set like a drink down near something that has electricity running through it, I think, okay, I could tip that over onto that and fry that. So let's not do that. So I'm always thinking of like, what could go wrong? In my life, I try to avoid those things. In my writing, I embrace them.
Right. The old adage, you know, run them up the tree and throw rocks at them, you know, put them in the worst possible scenario.
Absolutely.
And then see how they're going to get out of it. I love that. And you definitely throw a lot of rocks at your characters, so to speak, and keep them, you know, constantly having to adjust and readjust. And that's definitely, one of the reasons why your writing is so successful. So Hugh, another question that I have for you about Wool is obviously the story takes place underground. And I was really fascinated by that because I also have some stories where my characters are underground. So I was wondering if from your perspective, was there any kind of metaphorical or symbolic purpose to that? Or was it just simply, hey, they're in a silo, it's underground. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's in a silo. You could have had the silo above ground and had it still kind of like them stuck inside, but you put the silo underground. So they're, you know, kind of down deep into the ground. Was there any kind of metaphor or symbolism to that?
I think we can find some metaphor there, but my guess is that what's actually happening with all of these stories, because there are so many of them. And since Wool came out, I've had readers and people send me like every story that's ever had people living underground and say like, you must have read this. And I've not read any of them. And I've gone back to try to read them now. And I'm fascinated by how universal this construct is. And it got me thinking about, obviously, when you see something that arises in parallel like that from the froth of creativity, usually it hints at something that's innate in us. And in the way that when you find out like other kids, when I grew up pre-internet, so we didn't have like influences directly from people across the country around the world. And so when you find out that other kids your age played like the ground is lava game, and you're like, no, I invented that game with my friends. And you find out that everyone also invented that game with their friends. And then you find out that babies from birth crawling across a surface where there's like glass that extends off the surface, and they do this in an experimental setting. They won't extend out past where the solid surface ends to the glass part. Like they've never fallen in their lives, but they're hardwired with this fear of heights. Seeing some of these universal concepts and knowing that we do have some programming in us from birth,
right?
Then, man, everything starts popping up. Like the fact that when I was a kid, we used to build forts and take chairs and drape blankets over them and take cushions. And we want to basically bunker ourselves in and be under something and burrow. So I think what's happening with all of these stories is that we have a very basic impulse that when we're in danger, get under something, hide, bury yourself, crawl under a rock. That impulse is probably in us from the day we're born. And so when we're writing and we're thinking, this is a dangerous situation, where should the people be? Underground is just like a natural idea that pops up. We lived in caves before we lived in homes. So underground is like in our DNA. That's my best guess. There are metaphors we can come up for it, but I think those metaphors are tacked on to something that's a lot more innate and interesting.
Right. Kind of more of a primordial thing. So when you're thinking about a story, this dystopian, or about people that are having to deal with this really harsh reality, you know, that maybe that's a primordial response that our subconscious comes up with.
Yeah. And down is bad and up is good. Like it pervades our language.
Right.
Hell is under the soil and heaven is up in the air. So Telling a dystopian story with bright colors and in the clouds, like these are taking the language and, you know, decades of bias with our language and using it in a way that's going to subvert the theme and the mood that we're trying to generate in our stories. And if we're going to be good wordsmiths, we need to embrace the bias inherited in language in order to add weight and emotion to our stories. I think like being avant-garde to say, well, I'm going to tell a dystopian story where everything is like bright and beautiful and up. Well, that's awesome. And that's neat that you're doing something against the grain. If the story you're trying to tell is a dystopian story and you want people to feel dread, it's hard to do that while filling them with imagery that we associate with happiness and sunshine. So I think there's some of that going on as well, where we are basically using all the full weight and power of the language to our advantage when we try to set a mood.
Right. Hey, Robin, I think that you had a question or two for Hugh.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. I basically live in the silo 17 of the United States. And so my connection to the outside world can be tenuous. One of my questions, and I don't think you've mentioned this yet, Natalie, but as I was reading this book last April, actually a year ago today, I did the Everest Base Camp trek. And as I was reading this story and reading about the porters and your descriptions of them, Hugh, I pictured so easily and so well the porters that I saw along that trek. And my question for you was, you know, you travel the world. Were the porters in Wool inspired by the Nepalese Sherpa people? And what other aspects of the book were inspired by other cultures in the world?
Yeah, definitely the porters were inspired by Sherpa culture. I've never been lucky enough to hike to a major base camp like that. It's really cool that you've been able to do that. But I love those stories, and I've read like 50 or so alpining books, just about anyone that I can find, and gobble them up. I think the first short story in my science fiction collection, Machine Learning, is actually a science fiction alpining story, which I think are pretty rare.
Yeah.
One of the stories I'm working on right now is basically the daughter of a Sherpa and her experience growing up with her dad going off and doing this very dangerous job. So it's something I'm fascinated by, people who live in service to others like that and do a very dangerous and grueling task that other people basically not just won't do, but can't do, physically just aren't capable of doing. What other influences? You know, I've done a bit of traveling before I wrote Wool. I lived on a smaller sailboat when I was in college. When I dropped out of college, I sailed off to the islands and really immersed myself in a different culture for about a year. But I think what influenced the structure of that book the most was the fact that I had just gone from working in the yachting industry, where I was making like incredible money working for the rich and famous on these yachts in these really glamorous parts of the world, to quitting that job because it was hell in a lot of ways. You know, it sounds really glamorous, but it was working really hard for people who had everything and weren't even satisfied by that, and trying to constantly keep these people who can't be happy, trying to make them happy.
Right.
And I spent 2 years instead roofing, which paid a lot less and had a lot less cachet. And, you know, when you told people what you did, they didn't say, oh my God, you drive big fancy yachts. They're like, oh, you're a roofer. But man, I was keeping people dry, and I was working with really cool people that I loved and admired, and went home every day to spend time with my family, and wasn't living on the road, and felt super satisfied with what I was doing in life. That shift in cultures and seeing the difference in how these different people at either end of the spectrum lived, I think really influenced the story. And the idea of the up top and the down deep came from that. And what we should admire and what we should be more critical of definitely came from that transition in my life.
Yeah.
I love that.
So apparent, you know, too, where Jules is trying to keep the place running, you know, and she's thinking ahead. And without the folks down in mechanical, you know, the whole silo fails, whereas the people up top are just trying to look at the view outside. Robin, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, yeah, what you just said, Hugh, is also very apparent throughout the rest of the story. I made a note at the end of chapter 40 when Supply joined Mechanical for this uprising. Like, I choked up. I got teary-eyed because I love stories where it's not just like the people with the sexy jobs or the big titles are the ones who are standing up and doing something great. It's the people in Mechanical, the people in Supply, like the normal people we can relate to who are rising up to make a difference. And so I actually got all choked up at that part. And because I'm a sucker for revolutions, but I'm also a sucker for kind of the people who are oftentimes overlooked being the heroes of the story. And so that definitely, that mindset that you just mentioned permeated the story so well.
Yeah. And I like the way you just use the word mindset, because to me, that's where revolutions should take place, and the way that we place our values. We shouldn't have to burn things to the ground to make things better. And that's a big theme in Wool, that you burn everything to the ground and you might not have a good idea of what to replace it with. And that's just the story of revolution throughout time. It's very easy to critique and destroy things. But if you don't have an idea on how to improve them, you're just repeating a cycle, and a lot of people are getting hurt in the interim. But if we can change people's mindsets and see that, for instance, banks are not necessary. If we didn't have banks, we would survive just fine. And we know that because we survived for a long time before the concept of banks even came around. And in some communities, like you barn raise. And now people are using GoFundMe and crowdsourcing in the way that barn raising used to serve the same purpose and bypassing banks. People are inventing new kinds of currencies that are borderless and bankless. Banks are not necessary, but for banks to exist, you have to have plumbers and roofers and steel girder riveters and the people who built these edifices for these people to sit in. And yet, if we look at how we value these things, there are banking CEOs who get bonuses as they're fired for doing a terrible job of like 25 to 50 million all at one time.
Right.
You know, the kind of money that would change a lot of people's lives. And at the same time, they're trying to figure out how to, you know, shave 15 cents an hour off of the minimum wage that the people working in the banking institution are making at the bottom. And those people, to me, are so much more heroic and necessary and do more to fuel our economy and drive our society forward.
Robin and I talk about this, we've talked about this before. You know, there's always some asshole out there who's trying to like fuck it up for everybody. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are despots, there are tyrannies, yeah. there are madman CEOs. There's always some guy or gal whose only goal in life is to increase their own power. But the vast majority of human beings are wandering around the planet just trying to live a life, to feed their kids, clothe themselves, have a home, hang out with their buddies maybe on Friday night and have a beer or whatever. And so I love that you're writing stories that are inspirational to those folks. And it does remind me sort of the change in comic books too, Hugh. You talked about loving comic books. I grew up with them as well. Often comic books, the hero is the every guy. But I think maybe, I wonder if there's a move towards that in comics as well, to a certain degree, with guys like, you know, the Chimichanga guy. What's his name? You know.
I don't know that I know the Chimichanga guy.
The guy who eats chimichangas. Oh my gosh.
I want to know.
I like the idea of him.
He's really, he got burned, and so he wears the suit because he's all disfigured.
Deadpool.
Deadpool. Thank you.
Deadpool?
Why I couldn't think of that, I don't know. Cesspool, Deadpool.
I like that Chimichangas was the best description, like, to help us out.
Okay.
I live on the border. Everybody here eats chimichangas. Like, we, you know, that's like our thing.
I would love to blame that on the bourbon, but I don't think I can. It's just my brain wasn't working.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because he's like completely different than we're getting characters. We're getting heroes, comic book heroes that are different than the old school ones. They're like an everyday guy. They're just much more relatable.
I think it's also great that we're changing who some of these characters are. And it's so funny, the pushback by people who grew up with the characters a certain way, but like comics have always been a reflection of the time that they're written in. And the idea that these characters should stay the same as our society changes misses the point of what these comics were,
right,
you know, written for and intended for. And I love when, especially in the Marvel universe, because Stan Lee created a lot of these characters and he was such an activist,
right,
really early on. He's basically just an old hippie or was. And he's written the characters that have influenced me in my writing so much in such powerful ways. And he's been very vocal about the fact that he was always trying to tell like stories of different perspectives and the downtrodden. And he was an activist in his writing.
Right.
And it's amazing how many people are fans of his characters in the Marvel movies who throw around terms like social justice warrior and virtue signaling and these things that sound awesome to me. But I think that they have no idea of the source of the entertainment that they're enthralled by and how it has a history that runs counter to what they stand for.
One of my favorite parts of this, and this ties into what we've been talking about, but that you have these really relatable human characters in the story. And I'm around the same age as Jules. And I just really related to this woman, somebody who sort of is like going against the grain or what society has set up for her. And it's cool, I think, in 2019, reading this for the first time, I think you have a lot of women out there also who would read this and really relate to her and be like, yes, this is kind of what I'm striving for in life and in my world. And so I think you've created this really timeless character who is also going to age well, because she's sort of on this journey with women in 2019 who are kind of like pushing back and moving forward. And so I just wanted to throw out there like how refreshing I felt like her character was, because she was like this feminist in a very like subtle and unassuming way. And I really related to that. I liked the philosophy of this story. It just really resonated with me. And so I know Natalie talked about how she really enjoyed the opening chapters, Johns and Marnes. And I think the cool thing you've done with this story is put characters in motion who somebody, any reader in the world, can pick out and be like, I see myself there, or I relate to that person. And that was just something that was really cool to me as a reader.
Thanks. That's a huge compliment. I appreciate that. It's amazing thinking about the fact that this was written like in 2009, 2010, the things that seem ridiculous in the story, like even, you know, we didn't, this was before Snowden, and knowing that the government was like something that we just knowledge that we live with now was the subject of conspiracy theory back when I wrote Wool, which is the idea that the government might be keeping information about us or recordings. And that's, you know, basically what is happening at the heart of the silo. So it's weird how contemporary the novel feels when so much has changed since it was written. One of the first negative reviews I remember for Wool was that Bernard was like seemed too evil and too mustache twirly. I think you wouldn't make that, you wouldn't make that comment now when you've seen, you know, that there are people who, it's not that they're misunderstood, like they actually are damaged in a way that, that all they can do to make themselves feel better is to create damage in the world.
Right.
And there is, it's not just different perspectives. There is good and evil in the world. And of course it's complex and it's messy at times, but it's not, you know, the whataboutism, the idea that for everything on this side, there's something on that side, you know, that's nonsense. Sometimes one side is right and one side is wrong. While my stories try to have nuance and shades of gray, there should definitely be one side that you gravitate toward. And I think that that has been borne out by the world we live in now.
Right. Like there's no universe in which Bernard is a good guy, or shouldn't be a universe in which Bernard is a good guy.
I think the cool thing with Bernard is he's not a good guy, but he's a very gray guy, because you also see his motivations, which is cool throughout the story. You don't agree with them, but at least it's like, okay, I see. And that's why I would disagree with also the people saying he's like the villain in the tower, who's like, I'm going to destroy the world, because he did have a motivation for what he was doing, which, you know, maybe there's people in the world that like can relate to that. But yeah, I think the cool thing was that he was a gray villain. He wasn't a black or white villain, which I like.
Yeah, I think you should I think you should definitely understand where these villains come from.
Yeah.
And I think Bernard is a sympathetic character, like, but I think he can be sympathetic towards someone that was basically never had true connections or love in their life, never had to work for anything. I think there should be some compassion in the heart of our fear and desire of like needing to limit this person's damage to the world. Doesn't mean you can't also, it's basically like if a rabid dog wandered into a city, you wouldn't want anyone to go pet the dog, but you also would feel sorry for the dog because the dog has been, its brain's been hijacked.
Right. But you'd still probably put it down.
Yeah. You'd put it down or you're trying to limit its the danger. Not
positive, yeah. Natalie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's good to be able to figure out where these bad characters in our stories came from, rather than them just, you know, their purpose is just to make people upset. That is some people's purpose in life, but like how do they get that way? And peeling that back is interesting.
I think about J.K. Rowling and some of her comments about Voldemort. She did such a great job of showing us the backstory of how this evil character, the, you know, the villain, the bad guy, became what he is and why and all of that. And I think, if I recall right, there has been some interviews or some comments where she's had a bit of frustration over the fact that then people take, they're like Team Voldemort. It's like, no, you shouldn't be Team Death Eater. I mean, I think she's made it clear that Death Eaters are not okay. You can understand what creates the Death Eater without embracing the Death Eater side. So it's just as an aside, sort of a fascinating thing in our culture right now, where characters that have been bad guys, characters that have been villains, characters that are on the wrong side of the law, I see some people sort of embracing them as like they want to be on that side.
I think there's two really fascinating things about what you're saying there, because one of the sad things is that we're seeing people with those kind of inclinations have been greatly rewarded in our society.
Right.
And there was a study recently that showed like that it's like over 80% of CEOs that they looked into were diagnosed with psychopathy. And basically not having a conscience like is a benefit in business. So the way our system is set up, you're rewarded for being an unempathic person. That's not how we should structure our society. You know, we need to rethink these things.
Right.
And I think the challenge of how we empathize with villains is that if you rewind any terrible person's life, you can go back to a point where you should have nothing but love for that person. So if let's take like the worst, we'll the person who stands in for evil in many conversations, Hitler. If you go back to the day he was born and you know nothing about that guy, like all you can do is love this child. It's a baby. It's a blank vessel. And if you carry it forward for this many years where you can have nothing but love for this kid, and they're trying to decide that point where you should go from loving something to reviling it. It's not going to happen like in a moment.
Right.
And I think when someone like Rowling is delving into the innocent period of a character's life, you're going to place a lot of love and compassion into that person in that part of their timeline. But our brains are just really bad at compartmentalizing and saying we can't carry that love over beyond these actions that person's taken. And there's some point, even for loved ones and family members, where they've done enough bad that you can no longer confuse the love you had for them before you truly knew them with what you know about them now. Now you have to say, okay, you're not healthy. And this is, of course, happened so many times in relationships where it's like, but I used to love you and I'm confused because now you're a terrible person, but I still remember loving you. Well, right. Getting out of toxic relationships requires saying, you know, that love for you was misplaced, or I didn't know you enough yet, or you hadn't done enough of these bad things for me to give up hope. But now I have to say it was right to have loved you then. It's right to revile you now. And that's really difficult to pull off as a writer. And it's hard for us to even do as readers, I think.
Right. That's a really good point.
I think one of the most refreshing things about reading more of the... So we're going through this NPR list of the top 100 sci-fi fantasy books ever written. And a lot of them were written in the 60s, 70s, long ago. And I think it's really fascinating to read writers' takes on good and evil then and now, like with your book in 2011 and more recent ones even. I love that the modern books are exploring good and evil in these ways and are humanizing these villains that a lot of times past sci-fi fantasy, past novels of any kind, I guess, don't really do. They have the villain, but they don't really create the background. They don't give you any reason to empathize with them. And I think one of the cool things with modern storytelling is that empathy seems to be such a very powerful and important thing for us to explore. And I love that that's something that is a trend, that now I feel like if I read a book and I can't empathize at some point with the villain, to me, that is not a complete full work. And so I think that's a neat trend that I've seen in writing, that we are exploring that really human side to villains as well as to our heroines and heroes.
Have y'all seen Shazam yet?
I have not.
No, have not.
Oh, man. Well, everything you just said, think about it. Definitely go see the movie if you can. It's fantastic. But the villain is so well constructed. Like, you can totally get why they are the way they are. And I just love when movies or books or anything pull that off. And they did a great job with that. Killing Eve is another one that I thought was like really good at fleshing out the villain and making you understand them, even if you fear them.
Right.
I totally agree with you. We're doing a much better job with that as storytellers now, I think.
I think we're doing a much better job with writing generally in sci-fi and fantasy. I think that's something that Robin and I have noticed as we're reading some books from 40 or 50 years ago, is that it wasn't that the idea wasn't great, and the idea carries a story like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, or I think of Heinlein's A Stranger in a Strange Land. Great ideas and definitely worth reading. But the actual writing part, the actual storytelling has improved greatly. And so modern readers just, you know, we are lucky, lucky human beings to have so many amazing modern storytellers alive right now writing and being able to put their work out there for all of us to read without the gatekeepers and without the tastemakers dictating what we talk about or what we read about, which kind of leads us, a little segue here, Hugh, into another aspect of your life that we definitely want to talk about a little bit, was indie publishing. For those of you who are listening that don't know this, when Hugh first published Wool, he was really at the forefront of the indie publishing movement, the wave that happened. And you've been a real champion of indie publishing. So one of the questions that I have for you, Hugh, is what do you see on the horizon for the publishing industry right now? Is there anything that, you know, you're very tapped into it, and to now you have a traditional publishing deals, you have indie publishing still going on. What is your take on where we are now and where we're going?
The challenge I see for us today is just how to increase the amount of hours people are spending reading.
Yeah.
And I think there's some cool things coming along, like the rise of audiobooks, which plug into people's lifestyles a little bit better than the pure book experience, which is helping people, you know, read while they're driving and read while they're doing chores and on a commute. So, you know, what will self-driving cars do? Will it free up time for people to read more? I hope so. I hope it's not, you know, spend all that time, you know, streaming podcasts and playing video games and all these other forms of entertainment, which are awesome and I partake in. But if I'm looking at what's best for the literary community, like we need to grow the number of hours people spend reading. My best idea, I think, for how we do that is to get people to start loving books and not fearing them. And that's going to have to happen like really early on and change how we engage with students so that schools aren't teaching math out of books. Don't do anything that's uncomfortable with an object that's in the shape of a book. Because too many people are coming out of school and just equating books with suffering and pain, right. And they never pick up a novel for fun for the rest of their life. Like our industry relies on these avid readers who somehow avoid, and I'm sure the three of us were all those kinds of kids who avoided that stigma. But for every one of us, there's just too many people who see books as misery. Right. And we can change that. Like that's something that we've created and we've caused. English professors should not teach the classics. They should get people reading contemporary fun stuff and talk about storytelling and writing. It's just lazy. They're teaching the classics because all the answers are already there. They can just repeat what their professors told them. They don't have to do any work. And, you know, it's kind of a hazing ritual. Like they suffered through these books and now they're going to make other people suffer through them. And it's sad because there's like so many great books out right now and a much more variety of voices. To explore.
Absolutely.
And I've met teachers who are taking this route and they're graduating an entire classroom full of avid readers instead of just one or two out of the group. So I know it's possible.
Yeah.
We just don't seem to take that goal seriously or value it. But God, let's get more people reading and celebrate it more. And let's stop being petty about how people read. If people read on a Kindle, like let's celebrate that. My God, they're reading. It's so weird how we in-group and out-group within a minority culture. We're all doing the same thing. Like if you're reading a comic book, if you're reading, you know, nonfiction, fiction, how you're reading it, if you're doing it through audio or it's through a serialized podcast, it's all the same thing. It's amazing. And we're in this together and let's try to build that culture up instead of tear each other down.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to a high school once. I was speaking about writing at a high school, and I was meeting with a smaller group of students afterward. And I asked one of them, like, what do you like to read? And he was like, oh, no, I don't like to read. I only read manga and comic books. And I remember being just totally. I was totally floored because I was like, who the hell told you that manga and comic books aren't reading? And so I think you're absolutely right that people have made reading not fun. And the only outcome of that is that people don't read. It's not that they suddenly love the Scarlet Letter. It's that they say to hell with this whole thing. And so I agree that that is so important to, if you want to read the back of 100,000 magazines, like go you, like as long as you're reading something.
Totally.
Right. Because reading is that place where we take imagination and we're creating in our minds. And so it's so important for young people. Well, for all people, but the young brain, like you need to do that.
Totally.
Make that and come alive in your mind. Hugh, you were going to say.
Well, I think if you get people to fall in love with reading, they're going to explore the classics on their own, which is what happened for me. Like after I got out of school, I wanted to go back and read all the great books because at that point I loved books. But trying to get someone to do it the other direction, like get them to love books by making them read the least accessible books first, it's so asinine. And it's amazing that our entire like education system is predicated on that. And it just sets up the entire book industry for failure. And I'm shocked that publishers aren't more proactive in this way. Like they should be doing so much more outreach. They're basically not prospecting for new clients. You know, it'd be like oil companies just like, we're going to suck these fields dry, but we're not going to go look for more oil.
Right.
And publishers need to be sending authors to schools to talk more, knowing that it's not going to help sales for that author for that book right now, but that's what publishers seem to focus on. And to come up with these programs, like this is the new reading list. Like this is what we would...
Right.
Tell high school teachers today that they could teach and the new syllabus, basically. And I think publishers could get together instead of colluding on price and how to rip off readers, could get together and come up with ways to talk to educators in a way that would help the entire industry.
Well, you know how pharmaceutical companies fund research into drugs so they can sell them. Why can't publishing companies fund research into a new curriculum that uses their contemporary books?
That's a great idea. And what are the classics of tomorrow going to be if we're not doing that? How are these books going to make sense in 100 years, 200 years? Like we have to start embracing the now and telling the stories that are going to make books that are being written today future classics and branching out. Like, and there are now teachers who are teaching like Watchmen and some comics and graphic novels for their significance. And I think that's awesome. Like we got to break out break into the genres and like let people read romance. I don't think there should be any boundaries in how we engage kids. And I guarantee you're going to get people to read those, look at what they're already reading when they choose to read and just say, let's teach that curriculum.
Absolutely. If anybody's listening and needs another project, please create a list of the classics. And if you hate them, here's what you could read instead.
But speaking of books and television and people reading more, Wool has been optioned for a television series. If I recall right, you've been working with them on the script for the television series. Is that right?
Not really. I wrote a pilot a year ago, actually, just for my own learning process. I was in talks with a few different studios and producers, and we were kind of going through a bit of a conundrum on who to go with, and had too many awesome choices. And so I wrote a pilot and sent it out to everybody just to say, like, give me some feedback on this. And the people that really enjoyed the direction that I was thinking of going with the show are the people that I ended up signing with. But when it came to actually writing, I would rather have another creative who can devote their time and energy into this and make it their story as well. And so got to meet a lot of different prospective showrunners and pick one to carry the show forward. I'm honestly just too busy doing another dream that I've had my whole life, which is to sail around the world, and don't want to put that on hold to go, you know, live in LA and invest the time it would take to run this myself. So I've got several things in the works. And my guess is that the chances of any of them going forward are greatly diminished by the fact that I'm not really putting my energy or my presence into them. Most of these deals, they like want you to be there to help push it forward. And honestly, it's just not worth it for me, as much as I would love to see something get made as a geek.
Right.
I don't want to go sit in Hollywood for 10 or 20 years. I've got too many friends who've gotten really close and had nothing happen, or even friends who've gone through the gauntlet and had their show get made and get aired and then canceled in the first season. I've got several very close friends that have had that happen to them. I'm a fan of the stuff that comes out of Hollywood, but watching how the sausage gets made is like really dispiriting. And it's not something that I want to give up the other enjoyable parts of my life to be a part of. If someone makes something out of one of my books, that's awesome. If they don't, it's not going to upset me at all. I've got plenty of stories to consume that other people are producing and stories of my own to tell. And it's not something that I'm pinning a lot of hopes on, to be honest.
And if you don't, you'll still have seen the world. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
What's next for Hugh Howey?
Well, I have Halfway Home coming out this year from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's a book that I wrote a while back that never really promoted or did anything with, kind of like with Wool, and had a publisher and an editor read it and say like, oh my God, we need to get a wider audience for this. And right now we're back and forth with a couple of film and TV people about doing a deal for it. So there's a lot of excitement about this book. That's the next thing out. Working on three more books with John Joseph Adams. We did this apocalypse triptych a couple of years ago, and now we're doing a dystopian triptych. So I'm editing and writing stories for that. That's the book news and the sailing news. I'm heading back to Fiji in the next month or so and seeing some of my favorite islands again and exploring. And eventually I'll keep moving west and get back to Africa, close this loop, and then head back to the States. And God, I don't know where from there. I can only plan about 2 or 3 months out. So everything else beyond that's pretty just a dream and a foggy mystery.
That's so cool. We have so enjoyed having you on the show. We are Wool fans for sure, and we're fans of Hugh Howey, and you are an honorary tipsy nerd now. Oh. So we definitely would love to have you back sometime if you have new things to talk about. You know, we definitely want to hear about all of your adventures and your new works as they come out, if you're willing to put up with us tipsy girls again.
Absolutely. Natalie and Robin, it's been a huge pleasure. Thank you for an excuse to drink at 6 a.m. I don't normally get to do this.
Yeah. Thank you. It has been fun, and we totally appreciate you being here. So cheers.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Hugh. We appreciate it and we have enjoyed it so much. And best wishes on the sailing. Cheers, tipsy nerds.
Thank you so much. Cheers, ladies.
Oh, cool. You're still here. That means you were probably waiting around to hear the contest announcement for how you can win a signed copy of Wool by Hugh Howey and other nerdy swag. Well, the contest is really simple for listeners of the show. Each week, we will post trivia questions across our social media sites. Each right answer gives you an entry into the contest, and winners will be announced at the end of May. Full details are on our website, tipsynerdsbookclub.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Tipsy Nerds Book Club podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, and share the fun with your friends and family. Love what you heard and want the fun to continue? Head over to Patreon and become a patron of the Tipsy Nerds podcast. We love our patrons. Want a recipe for a cocktail you heard here? You can find recipes as well as show notes, episode transcripts, and helpful links on our website, tipsynerdsbookclub.com. And as always, join us next week for a new episode of Libations and Geeking Out. Cheers.